The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is. Cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello, and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm producer K.O. Myers. This week, we bring you an hour with Daniel Loxton. Daniel returns to the show to share the reasonableness of weird things, his keynote address from LogicCon 2011. But first, Daniel sits down for an exclusive interview with our host, Desiree Shell, to share his take on science and skepticism and the power of stories to communicate across cultural boundaries. Thanks for listening.
I'm here today with Daniel Loxton, the editor of Junior Skeptic, the 10-page kids science section in Skeptic magazine, and the author of the children's book, Evolution: How We and All Living Things Came to Be. Welcome back, Daniel.
Hi, thanks for having me again.
So a bit later on the show, we'll be airing your keynote speech from LogicCon, which was a science and critical thinking event held here in Edmonton. But your presentation was quite a bit more personal than most of the presentations I've seen at the TELUS World of Science. So without spoilers, why did you decide to go in that direction?
Well, as some of your listeners may know, I'm involved in skepticism, which is an intellectual tradition that involves criticism. It involves trying to debunk or challenge some popular beliefs. And this kind of critical discourse can become very adversarial. And on occasion, some of my colleagues, people in my field, can be a little condescending, a little full of themselves. And so this seemed like a great opportunity to talk about how believers, these other people that we're talking about all the time, they aren't really other people. They're actually me. They're my loved ones. They're the people I went to school with. They're the people listening right now. They're just regular people. There is no us and them. There's just understanding. There's different rations of knowledge, different access to teaching and education, different levels of science literacy. And so I wanted to talk about how our individual backgrounds shape our worldviews. And I wanted to talk about how my background shaped a believer, shaped a paranormal believer, an enthusiast. And yet at the same time, it gave me many of the lessons. My paranormal background gave me many of the lessons that skeptics try to impart now, ideas about critical thinking and looking deeper and asking deep questions. I got a lot of these same things from my very paranormal background.
So would you consider your presentation to be science communication?
I hope so. Yeah, I would. I hasten to add at this point, I'm not a scientist, but I am now in the business of science writing, for kids in particular. So I have, I've come from a background of being a pseudoscience geek and a sci-fi geek and also a science enthusiast, and seeing those all as connected, and now having the opportunity to understand more and to share people, share that same kind of journey and insight, the things that I've, fallen in love with over the years, to share those same things with an audience of book and magazine readers, which is it's a really exciting position to be in, but it's one about which I'm more than a little humble, because I'm basically a beginner, so I'm taking a lot of my cues from greats of science popularization. You'll hear in the speech, I make quite a bit of reference to Carl Sagan, the late great Cornell astronomer Carl Sagan.
Well, tell us a little bit more about Sagan.
Well, Sagan was an interesting guy, and I'm not a Sagan biographer either, but he was one of the original founders of an organization called PSYCOP, the Committee for the Scientific Investigation of Claims of the Paranormal, which was the first organized skeptics group in North America in the 1970s. But he was a guy who was, he was doing science outreach, science popularization on the very largest of world stages. And in doing that, he didn't necessarily have a lot of time for kind of splashing around in this skeptical backwater where where I work, and which I happen to love. And Sagan also loved it, but you know he had bigger fish to fry. But near the end of his life, he sat down and he wrote, I think, the greatest skeptical book ever written. And it was a huge influence on me when I was coming up in skepticism, when I was discovering skepticism, which is all described in the speech. And I think it's still the best example of what scientific skepticism can be. It's a book called The Demon-Haunted World, published in 1996.
On Skeptically Speaking, we talk a lot about science in the media, how to translate, I guess, science for lay people, and how often it's misinterpreted or presented particularly badly. So do you think that telling stories can be a better way of offering that kind of information?
Well, in some sense, it's the only option. You know, so some of your listeners might remember an episode of Star Trek The Next Generation, well, TV show, where the captain ends up on a planet with an alien captain, and they're unable to communicate through the entire script. Because the alien captain speaks only in references to a literature from another planet. and they're unable to comprehend each other. You know, they're just not able to bridge that gap. Well, human beings are a little bit like that. You know, we speak in stories. That's how we communicate. And, you know, science, to some extent, these scientific stories of experiments and understanding are told in math or data, but ultimately it boils down to storytelling. You know, somebody says, here's something we wondered about. Here's how we went about finding out the answer. Here's the answer we discovered and the journey we went through. And then there is a story behind that story. An example I was looking at today, there was quite a famous parapsychology laboratory at one point, studying psychic phenomena, alleged psychic phenomena. And there was a guy there who had achieved quite a bit of prominence in parapsychology doing animal psi experiments. He was testing animals who seemed to have telekinetic powers. And he was writing this up in formal papers you know, making a splash. And the story told in the papers was animals are psychic. But there was a story behind that as well, which his colleagues discovered when they installed a peephole. And the story was that he was systematically cheating. he was inventing the results. They installed a peephole, and they also installed a second machine that took independent readings from these animals. Anyway, he made up the whole thing, eventually confessed. That's the story behind the science. And then there's another level of storytelling where I have just told you, you know, and I've understood the story as I've heard it, and hopefully I've passed it on to you and with reasonable accuracy. That's what I try to do. But yeah, it's ultimately, it all comes down to storytelling.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking. I'm talking to Daniel Loxton, editor of Junior Skeptic and the author of Evolution, How We and All Living Things Came to Be. Now, Sagan's kind of the gold standard for this kind of warm and fairly awe-inspiring narrative. And I've heard for years that what we need is another Sagan to really help people love science again. But I've also had conversations with people about how his methods might not be as effective now, because he and his turtlenecks were on TV at a time when there were far fewer channels. You know, viewers didn't have the choice that they do now. So do you think that was a part of it? Just the timing?
It's always about timing, but Sagan was a powerful, powerful voice. You know, if you look up his, look up Pale Blue Dot on YouTube, listen to him speak. You can find little bits on the internet, no problem. You'll find that it's pretty hard not to be moved, even today. You know, we're used to 3D movies and video games and YouTube, but ultimately we're human beings, and the romance that Sagan was tapping into, that hasn't changed because humans haven't changed. And I've thought about this quite a bit. You know, Sagan, on one hand, it's hard to argue with success. 500 million people saw his miniseries Cosmos about astronomy. You know, that kind of Oscars level of access to science education is just astonishing. But similar levels of success, huge, huge success. Think about a series like Planet Earth, the recent BBC wildlife series. That's actually not different from the kind of shows that we grew up with. You know, I remember Mutual of Omaha's Wild Kingdom.
That was the best show.
It was, yeah. But see, Planet Earth is not different in format, not really. They've got better cameras, they've got more practice, but it's still basically send some guys out and take footage of animals and tell a little story about that, you know, that teaches people something about the lives of that species. It's really traditional wildlife photography, wildlife videography. Ultimately, I think that that audiences haven't changed that much.
Would you consider a show like MythBusters to be in that category?
I once had the opportunity of asking the hosts when I interviewed them for Skeptic Magazine whether they consider themselves part of the skeptical literature, and they said yes, absolutely. And I talked to them about how really old-fashioned the show is. You know, they blow some stuff up. They've come up with a lot of innovations, but really, it's a couple of guys trying to solve some little mysteries. It's a traditional science show in some ways. It's a traditional build show in many ways. It's just doing many of the same things better than have been done before. And I think that's the horizon to look toward, incremental improvements over the lessons of the past. So, you know, it's the great lesson of science, incremental improvements over the lessons of the past.
Nicely done. Are there any challenges with that kind of narrative science communication, with using the narrative approach or with making science more personal, I guess?
Well, sure. You know, the thing about stories is that they move us. You know, that's why it's a powerful tool for science communicators. But it's also a powerful tool for manipulators. Every election cycle, we see these kind of often manufactured stories that frame the issues in a way that you know, that focus groups say voters will find compelling. That kind of manipulation is also a natural part of being human. That we, you know, think of it like this. You know, if I say anything to you, I have to make certain editorial decisions. You know, am I going to speak in English? Am I going to scream or am I going to talk? Am I going to lie down or stand up? All these kinds of things, and it's a normal part of communication. But also those, you know, that kind of self-reflection about how we talk and how we communicate, whether we have a good-looking presenter, whether they wear blue, or you know, these kinds of things.
Right.
There's this is huge science of persuasion. Now, science communicators are trying to do a good thing. They're trying to impart good information to people who need it, who can benefit from the information. And so they want to use the tricks that are available. They want to have pictures. They want to have attractive presenters. They want to have people who speak well. You know, they want to have cool TV shows like MythBusters. But all those things can be sources of manipulation as well. And so, you know, at the end of the day, we have to, as an audience, we have to keep our thinking cap on no matter who we're listening to. We have to recognize and appreciate the tricks and also learn to see through them when they seem inappropriate.
Daniel, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you very much for having me.
You can find Daniel Loxton's work at skepticblog.org or the link on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. Before we get to Daniel's Logicon keynote, The Reasonableness of Weird Things, let's listen to Carl Sagan, who made this all seem easy.
From this distant vantage point, the Earth might not seem of any particular interest. But for us, it's different. Consider again that dot. That's here. That's home. That's us. On it, everyone you love, everyone you know, everyone you ever heard of, every human being who ever was, lived out their lives. The aggregate of our joy and suffering, thousands of confident religions, ideologies, and economic doctrines. Every hunter and forager, every hero and coward, every creator and destroyer of civilization, every king and peasant, every young couple in love, every mother and father, hopeful child, inventor and explorer, every teacher of morals, every corrupt politician, every superstar, every supreme leader, every saint and sinner in the history of our species lived there, on the mote of dust, suspended in a sunbeam.
The late Carl Sagan reading from his book, The Pale Blue Dot, with music by Hans Zimmer. You can see an animation of Sagan's narration by artist Adam Winnick at skepticallyspeaking.com. Skeptically Speaking wants you to question everything. To be a part of the discussion, call and record your question on our listener question line at speak73101. That's 773-257-3101. Long-distance charges may apply. Sunday nights at 6 Mountain Time, join our Ustream chat room to listen and ask questions as we record interviews live. Just click the Listen Online button at skepticallyspeaking.com. You can also email your questions and comments to live@skepticallyspeaking.com, or if you're on Twitter, tweet us at Skeptical Radio. To find out where Skeptically Speaking airs near you, to listen to past episodes, or download the weekly podcast, check out our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, follow the links to connect with us on our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, or to subscribe to the show in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
Hello, everybody. Thanks for having me here. I'm Daniel. As you've just heard, I'm the editor of Junior Skeptic, which is the 10-page kids science section bound into Skeptic magazine. Skeptic is published by the nonprofit Skeptic Society, and it boasts a lot of recognizable science names on the editorial board. Bill Nye, Jared Diamond, the late Stephen Jay Gould during his life. There are now many skeptical organizations all around the world, and they all go back to great crime solvers like magician Harry Houdini. The idea is to use the tools of science and scholarship to solve apparently paranormal mysteries, just like Scooby-Doo. Junior Skeptic was created for a very natural human reason. People everywhere, whatever they call themselves, they share a wish to teach their insights and their values to their children. The skeptical community is no different in this respect. It was inevitable that eventually someone would make it a priority to do something for the kids. The Skeptic Society is one of the first organizations to put funding behind this impulse, and so we have Junior Skeptic. In interviews, I'm often asked, does this mean that you're trying to indoctrinate kids? That's actually a fair question, I think, but the answer is no. Skeptic isn't a lifestyle magazine. It's not an atheist magazine. It's a science magazine. The values Junior Skeptic tries to share are the values of curiosity, scholarship, and investigation. Those are shared human values. They belong to everybody. Nobody owns science or critical thinking, and yet no one is born knowing them either. These are things that must be taught. Usually when I'm asked to speak to the media or on stage, is to address something specific to my areas of niche expertise, often legendary monsters or technical minutiae to do with the skeptical movement itself. When I was invited to speak here today, I was encouraged to write something more personal, and so that's what I've done. I'd like to try and explain how the heck a goofy Canadian kid, a kid who was a passionate believer in the paranormal, by the way, wound up as a skeptical investigator. But first, to help set the stage, I'd like to share an anecdote told by one of my heroes, the late great astronomer Carl Sagan. Sagan was involved in skepticism even before the first North American skeptics organizations were formed in the 1970s, but he didn't spend a lot of time contributing to our niche literature. He had bigger science communication projects to tackle. Consider that 500 million people saw cosmos. But at the end of his life, during a short window of recovery from the disease that killed him, Sagan wrote an entire book about pseudoscience and the paranormal called The Demon-Haunted World, Science as a Candle in the Dark. It's widely considered the finest skeptical book ever written, and I agree. Now, although Sagan often spoke with famous people, from Johnny Carson to the Dalai Lama, he opened his skeptical masterpiece with a description of a conversation with a complete stranger. I share that story here because that stranger reminds me so much of me. One day, Sagan got into a car sent to meet him at the airport. The driver, Mr. Buckley, was excited when his passenger turned out to be that scientist guy. As we settled into the car for the long drive, Sagan wrote, he told me he was glad I was that scientist guy. He had so many questions to ask about science. Would I mind? No, I didn't mind, and so we got to talking. But not, as it turned out, about science. He wanted to talk about frozen extraterrestrials, languishing in an Air Force base near San Antonio, channeling crystals, the prophecies of Nostradamus, astrology, the Shroud of Turin. He introduced each portentous subject with buoyant enthusiasm. Each time, I had to disappoint him. The evidence is crummy, I kept saying. There's a much simpler explanation. This may sound familiar to you. Quite a few people have had an awkward experience of this sort, perhaps cornered by that well-meaning relative at the family reunion. It could even be that you've edged away from a conversation like that, thinking, wow, this person is sort of a nut. Dismissiveness is a human sort of response between people with different views, but it is not terribly fair. Sagan's approach was a little different. He talked to Mr. Buckley at length about Buckley's passionate interests, about his knowledge of mainstream science, and Sagan came away understanding the situation a lot better. The taxi driver believed a lot of things that scientists know to be factually incorrect, but he was not a nut, not stupid, and not intellectually lazy. Quite the opposite. He was bright, reasonable, and well-read. The problem was that he was reading the wrong stuff. Sagan wrote, Mr. Buckley, intelligent, curious, had heard virtually nothing of modern science. He had a natural appetite for the wonders of the universe. He wanted to know about science. It's just that all the science had gotten filtered out before it reached him. Sagan considered this a failure of our culture. He felt that this man had been cheated out of something beautiful, something he hungered for and deserved. He was cheated out of his chance to appreciate the true majesty and mystery of creation, of the universe. As a theme I'd like to emphasize today, science literacy, critical thinking, skepticism, all these are things that must be taught. It doesn't matter how clever we are. It doesn't matter how we identify ourselves. At the end of the day, we're at the mercy of our sources. Our beliefs are only as accurate as the information we have to work with. So I'd like to share some of my own story and explain how I wound up as a professional skeptic. I certainly didn't start that way. It amuses me sometimes to think of pioneering skeptics like magician James Randi springing ready-made from the egg, two-fisted, square-jawed, and ready to fight crime. But that's not how things work in real life, or at least not how they worked in mine. I grew up in an Airstream trailer. My family spent winters in Victoria, British Columbia, because my dad's an Aussie and he can't hack the real Canada. We just find a beach somewhere and pull up the trailer and presto, we were home. Something happened on one of those beaches, something that shaped my career to this day. I'll come back to that, but I'll give you a hint. It involved a bloody big monster. Summers we spent in remote bush camps in the BC interior. My parents were tree planting contractors. They hired crews to plant new trees on BC's rugged clearcuts. In the late 1970s, tree planting camps were the last refuge for first-generation hippies like my parents, plus lots of bright, outdoorsy, new college kids. Crews often had 50 or 60 planters isolated in the exact middle of nowhere. In the middle of that, my brothers and I enjoyed a childhood that was a near-optimal mix of utopian and feral. We spent our days on our own getting into trouble near camp while the planters were out banging trees in the ground. It was really pretty glorious, catching frogs, catching fish, digging in the dirt with the dogs. I remember looking up from a Spider-Man comic one time and finding myself face-to-face with a bear. That sort of thing happened a lot. In the evening, we'd play chess with the planters, or hang out in the sauna with all the nudists, or watch these college kids get stoned and quote Monty Python. They seemed like intellectual titans to us at the time. That sounds funny, but there was a lot of truth to it. We were around adults a lot from a young age, and we shared in a rich life of ideas. And our parents were central to that intellectual life. My folks are and were very bright and very weird. My dad in particular comes from a long line of dreamers and schemers. The Loxtons are positively in love with ideas. They live to peel back the appearance of things, make the connections others overlook, see how things really work. They refuse to blindly accept common wisdom. They are people who ask tough questions, who want to know, really, how do you know that exactly? You may recognize these as the habits of good, solid, critical thinking. And you're right. Absolutely, you're right. But that same critical, inquisitive path can lead in more than one direction, as we'll see. We'll look first at how my parents exposed me to skepticism. My father has always been a wonderful storyteller. When my brothers and I were little, my dad would tuck us into bed, bristle our cheeks with his stubble, and tell us stories or poems. Our favorites were tales of his own childhood, growing up poor on the edge of the desert in South Australia. His Tom Sawyer-like childhood sounded magical to us, racing horses bareback over red sand, plucking heavy oranges from the trees of his family's tiny fruit farm, catching yabbies in the hidden backwaters of the River Murray. Many of these stories had a subversive edge to them, I realize now. Many were direct lessons in skepticism. I'd like to read you one of those as I remember it 30 years later, exactly the same way I recently told it to my own son. Once upon a time, your grandpa farmer was a little boy like you. He had a mother and father and six brothers and sisters. They were very poor and did not have the toys and treats that I had growing up or that you have today. They trapped rabbits for food for their family, which was bad for the rabbits, but good for Australia. Every day, the kids would run barefoot over the burning sand to their schoolhouse, uphill both ways, until one day, my dad's mother came home with a rare and special treat, something almost too precious to believe. It was a chocolate bar. The children gathered around in amazement. Their mouths watered, their eyes sparkled. As their mother carefully unwrapped the foil, the chocolate seemed to glow with deliciousness. It seemed to sing. Carefully, carefully, their mother broke the bar into 7 equal pieces, 2 small, sweet squares for every child, and these she put into the children's lunches. That day, my father ran to school. He could hardly believe his good fortune. All day he dreamed of chocolate. It felt to him like lunchtime would never come. But lunchtime did come in the fullness of time, and trembling, my father took out his small, chocolatey treasure. "What you got there, mate? Candy?" It's one of the bigger kids. "Yes," said my father, "it's a special treat. Can I have some?" My father held the chocolate a little closer. "I'm sorry," he said, "I don't have very much." The other boy considered this. "What about a trade?" he asked. "I don't know," my father replied. "What have you got?" "I'll tell you what," the other boy offered. "If you give me your chocolate, I'll let you have a ride on my elephant." He beamed at his own generosity. "Why, you don't really have an elephant, do you?" "Oh, sure we do," assured the big kid. "My father got him from a circus. We use him on the farm for plowing and stuff like that. He's stronger than a team of bullocks, but he's tame as a kitten. We ride him all the time. Also, he can jump over a tree. I can bring him to school with me tomorrow." Now, my father hardly knew what to do. He loved chocolate, but what kid could pass up a chance to ride on a real live elephant? Swiftly, the deal was made. They shook hands, and the big kid ate up that chocolate in 2 seconds flat. That night, my father could hardly sleep. He raced through his breakfast the next day and practically flew across the sand to his school. He turned breathless into the schoolyard and saw, of course, no elephant. Puzzled, he went and found the older boy. "Sorry about that," said the boy. "My folks needed the elephant home on the farm today. I'll bring him tomorrow." The next day, my father was twice as excited and ran to school twice as fast, but again, no elephant. "Yes, sorry," the older boy told him. "He needed a washing today. Big job to wash an elephant. I'll bring him tomorrow." But the next day, the elephant was missing once more. "Sore foot today. I'll bring the elephant tomorrow for sure." At this point, I stopped and asked my own little boy, What do you suppose happened next? Did Grandpa Farmer ever get his ride on that elephant? My son frowned, his eyes deadly serious. No, he said, his voice tense with the knowledge of injustice. That other boy was lying. Now, speaking of lying, my father had a simple tool for teaching us skepticism. He constantly told us outrageous whoppers. The challenge was to call him on those and explain why we thought they were false. One of my favorites happened at dinner one night when I was about 10, when my dad insisted the Earth was flat. We knew all about astronauts and all that stuff, but he pointed out that those movies and pictures could be fake. Didn't we see General Zod attack moon astronauts in Superman 2? And hey, you kids do know Han Solo wasn't really in space, right? And so began the great Loxton flat Earth debate. The centerpiece of my dad's case was a demonstration. What he did was this. He took a piece of cheese and he bit it into the shape of a sailing ship and he sailed it along his plate and then it fell off. See? Now, we knew somehow that that didn't quite clinch his case. But explaining exactly what was wrong with his pretend views was the challenge. And I wonder, off the top of your head, how many of you could prove the Earth is round and how many of you could have done it when you were 10? We didn't do a very good job, as it happens, but but we tried. And that sort of fun skeptical exercise, we did a lot of that sort of thing in my family, teaching games. We also had a few that stung. Even though my father's father, once won 70 acres in a card game, my dad taught us very, very painfully about the non-existence of a sure bet. I won't tell you the story because it would embarrass him, but suffice it to say that for several memorable, tearful hours, my dad owned my piggy bank, my toys, and all of my teddy bears. And so I can say that we were taught the lessons of skepticism from a very young age. Over and over, my parents hammered it home, find out for yourself, don't trust anybody, and as my brothers and I joked, especially don't trust dad. My parents gave us a rock-solid background in skeptical thinking. It served us pretty well. One of my brothers is a paleontologist. The other is teaching political science classes at Harvard nowadays. They're both jerks. No, we're actually really close. They help me on Junior Skeptic all the time. But my parents also gave me something else, a wide range of beliefs, some involving the paranormal. To begin with, my parents were original era hippies. They had the draft in Australia. Some of my dad's childhood friends never came back from Vietnam. Like all parents, they taught us their values, both as hippies and as entrepreneurs. That war is a great evil, that both governments and corporations can be incompetent and untrustworthy, that altruism matters, that the environment is a delicate, unraveling tapestry, and that we're constrained by the realities of human nature. Some of those I think of now as humanist values. They were health food fanatics, of course, and the veggie dogs we ate tasted like styrofoam extruded right out of the prototype vats. My kindergarten career lasted only 2 days before ending in a food-related crisis. My mom pulled me out when she learned that all the mothers were required to take turns providing store-bought cookies for snack time. Of course, there's nothing wrong with nutritious food, but they extended that to amorphous fears of toxins. My parents often took steps to detoxify the body, yogurt fasts and things of that nature. Yogurt's yummy, so that's all to the good. And these measures seem to work for them. That's why they bothered. Mind you, medical researchers have learned the hard way that seems to work can be very misleading. The notion of blinded clinical trials was an invention of necessity. Consider the mesmerism craze that raged through aristocratic France during the 1700s. A slick medical guru named Franz Anton Mesmer sold the idea that the whole universe was filled with an invisible fluid that caused everything from the motion of the planets to human wellness. Mesmer claimed that he could harness this mystical energy, called animal magnetism, to cure the sick. Patients flocked to mesmerism clinics to receive a wide variety of treatments involving this mystical energy force. Group treatments were conducted by having patients sit in a circle around a tree that had been mesmerized, charged with mystical energy, or around a tub full of iron filings that had been mesmerized. These treatments seemed to work. During treatments, patients would often scream and thrash violently for up to 3 hours. Afterwards, many of these patients testified that they were cured. This became such a craze that the French king appointed a top-notch scientific commission to dig into it, including big-gun scientists like Benjamin Franklin and Antoine Lavoisier. They realized that they needed a way to separate what seemed to be going on from what was actually happening. The first question was whether the forest existed at all. As the commission's report put it, "The question of existence is primary. The question of utility is not to be addressed until the first has been fully resolved. Animal magnetism may well exist without being useful, but it cannot be useful if it does not exist." They discovered that mesmerism only worked on people that believed in it, and then only if patients knew they were being treated. A mesmerized tree could send patients into convulsions, but if one out of a group of trees were secretly mesmerized, patients could not tell which one it was. Patients could feel what parts of their bodies were being mesmerized, unless they were blindfolded. Most damning, patients went into convulsions when they were told they were being mesmerized, even when they were not. The commission concluded that they had demonstrated by decisive experiments that the imagination without magnetism produces convulsions, and that magnetism without imagination produces nothing. Now, it's not that my folks didn't like science. They actually loved it. They just didn't know very much about it. My dad tells a story about being caned right out of his desk at school as a little boy for his answer to the question, "If steel is heavier than water, what keeps a battleship from sinking?" My dad's answer was surface tension, and that got him a whack. But they were smart, curious people. Of course they were inspired and moved by science. It's just that they got their knowledge of science from popular culture. They'd get a bit from the news here, another bit from a sci-fi movie there, another bit from a documentary or a magazine in a doctor's office or something someone told them at a dinner party, just like everybody else. But they were moved by what they knew. My dad would sometimes say, "Close your eyes, kids, and imagine a sandstorm a mile high and 100 miles wide, opaque with the swirling motes of dust. Now imagine that every one of those tiny specks, billions upon billions upon billions, is a sun. Just think how many planets there must be, and imagine the life that must live out there." With that sort of cosmic perspective, it's not surprising that he found UFO claims intensely plausible. Who wouldn't? I certainly did. Until you dig deeper, alien spacecraft claims look pretty damn good. Countless thousands of people have seen UFOs, and I'm not just talking about lights in the sky. Thousands of people personally remember being taken on board these things. So it's not surprising that about a third of adults believe that extraterrestrial beings have visited the Earth. Sagan nailed this problem when he was describing his conversation with Mr. Buckley, the driver. "A bright and curious person who relies entirely upon popular culture to be informed about something like Atlantis is hundreds or thousands of times more likely to come across a fable treated uncritically than a sober and balanced treatment." Maybe Mr. Buckley should know to be more skeptical about what's dished out to him by popular culture, but apart from that, it's hard to see how it's his fault, Sagan said. He simply accepted what the most widely available and accessible sources of information claimed was true. As a result, Sagan said, Mr. Buckley was systematically misled and bamboozled. I can relate, because the exact same thing happened to me. My folks had some wonderful books that served up some wonderful baloney. As a kid, I went through them like a chainsaw. Psychics, aliens, spontaneous human combustion, wonderful stuff. But it wasn't just the stuff that my parents had that they were reading. Skeptics sometimes downplay the fundamental reasonableness of basing conclusions on your own direct, personal, visceral experience of the world. Direct experience is how you know where you parked your car or whether you like jalapenos. And direct experience is the reason that many people hold paranormal beliefs. For example, I know several people who believe in ghosts for the perfectly straightforward reason that they personally saw a ghost. They're willing to consider alternate explanations, but of course their personal ghost encounter leans heavily on the scales of evidence. Science may say it's wise for Ebenezer Scrooge to suppose Marley's specter may be an undigested bit of beef, a blot of mustard, but Christmas Carol audiences understand that ghost belief would be pretty reasonable under the circumstances. This happened to my own mother. Shortly after the birth of my youngest brother, she woke up to a spectral attack. An apparition of a man was on top of her, choking her, holding her down on the bed. She couldn't move, and she could see the ghost. I don't know about you, but that would scare the heck out of me. And her story had a real hair-raising impact on me when I first heard it as a young teen. Now, here's what my mom and I did not know and didn't learn until many years later. Science has a rock-solid explanation for her ghost attack or for experiences like it. Turns out that as much as half the population may experience something called sleep paralysis. When we sleep, our motor system is shut down so we don't hurt ourselves. This is like a parking brake. But it doesn't always work perfectly. Some people thrash around in their sleep, or they get up and they make a sandwich, and other people remain paralyzed for a minute or two after they wake up, or while they're waking. Since this happens at the transition between sleep and wakefulness, it often comes with hypnopompic hallucinations, dreams intermixed with awareness of our surroundings. The classic sleep paralysis experience combines physical paralysis with a feeling that we are being pushed down, with a sense and sometimes vision of a figure in the room with us, usually on top of us or at the foot of the bed. This has been scaring people as long as there have been people. It's recorded in folklore from around the world. Think of hag riding or medieval succubus attacks. Here's a Susan Clancy, a Harvard psychologist who studied the relationship between sleep paralysis and claims of alien abduction, described her own personal sleep paralysis experience. "What the hell just happened? This is what most people who've had such an experience want to know. It's definitely what I wanted to know the first time it happened to me, and I had just written a paper on the topic." Although the phrase non-pathological desynchrony in sleep cycles kept running through my head the whole time, this certainly didn't alleviate the disorientation or the terror or the gasping for breath. "The physicality of it was overwhelming," she wrote. My folks believed in psychics for a very similar reason. A psychic once made uncanny predictions about their life together, things she couldn't possibly have known. Now, I trust most of you are aware that the story of psychics is not so simple, but it's hard to argue with persuasive personal experience. When you've seen one prediction come true, how easy is it to dismiss another? In 1988, the west coast of North America seethed with fears that Nostradamus had predicted a devastating earthquake. Here's how the Toronto Star put it on May 10th. "By 10 a.m. today, the Star's Vancouver office, this reporter, indeed all of Canada's west coast, is scheduled to have been swept into the Pacific Ocean by a giant earthquake. Nostradamus said so, and hundreds of British Columbians believe him. They're following the lead of Californians and are heading for the mountains, the interior, or anywhere they can to escape the quake and resulting huge tidal wave that is set to wipe out Canada's third largest city." My parents kept us home that day, home and close to our earthquake kits. They reasoned that it's better to be safe than sorry. Now, as kids, we were irritated by this because we missed out on an outing we'd really been looking forward to. But on the other hand, earthquake kits were a good idea anyway, so win some, you lose some. Now, you may at this point feel like there's something unfortunate about my childhood, but I don't feel that way. My parents taught us that the universe is an awesome adventure, an adventure built on curiosity. They were just off on a few of the details. From them, I got my interest in popular science, in science fiction, and in pseudoscience, and I saw those all as naturally connected, intertwined, and I still sort of feel that way. My career investigating paranormal mysteries is a seamless continuation of my childhood conviction that I would grow up to solve paranormal mysteries. I started early. First, I read all my father's books. They had titles like We Are Not the First or Chariots of the Gods. Compelling stuff. Then I devoured everything I could find in the library of Machosin Elementary School. Those books unanimously assured me that psychics and monsters and flying saucers were definitely the real deal. How could anyone argue with such a mountain of evidence? I fell in love with the paranormal in general, but my special love was and is something called cryptozoology. The word means study of hidden animals and refers to legendary creatures like Bigfoot and the Loch Ness Monster. Why that topic over all others? Well, Monsters are super cool. And also, let me read you a story that will, I think, shed some more light on how I find myself a cryptozoology critic today. Here my father describes how he and my mother personally witnessed BC's coastal sea serpent, Cadbrosaurus. We were camped in our silver travel trailer at Island View Beach in Victoria, right by the water. We were young and happy and life was good. We had a morning ritual of sitting up in bed and looking out to sea while we enjoyed our morning cup of tea. This particular beautiful morning, we thought we saw Cadbrosaurus. We both saw it at the same time and both said something stupid like, "Hey look, a sea serpent," followed by embarrassment at what we had just said. We jumped up in our bathrobes and ran barefoot to the water's edge. There it was, swimming along just 40 feet or so from shore. It was swimming parallel to the beach and making pretty good time. We had to walk briskly to keep up with it, and we wished we had the camera. We were both saying things like, "It's definitely a sea serpent. See the head? I can even see its eyes." It was about 30 feet long, dark in color and clear as day. It had a head and neck and many humps. It was swimming along in perfectly coordinated undulating motion. It appeared to be very real, alive, and very clearly a sea serpent. So what was it, really? That's the question, isn't it? My father actually had a skeptical interpretation of this particular experience. My mother thought it was Cadbrosaurus. But as a kid, it seemed obvious to me. It was a monster, and I was going to catch it. For years, I dreamed of just that. I scoured Radio Shack catalogs for monster hunting equipment, and I designed logos for my coming Cadbrosaurus expeditions. I got my local librarian to help me write to the Loch Ness Phenomena Investigation Bureau. In the fifth grade, I saw monster hunting tips from a Ouija board, which, incidentally, is not that weird by monster hunting standards. I devoured everything I could get my hands on, all of it. But all of it came from the pro-paranormal literature. I was unusually passionate about this material. I was deeply interested in exploring these mysteries. And yet, I just had no idea that any sort of critical literature existed. And how could I? At that time, there were no skeptical magazines sold on newsstands. There were no podcasts or blogs. There was no Google. You had the New Age section of your local bookstore or library. And you had what you saw on TV on shows like In Search Of. And that was it. That changed for me when I was 16. I discovered skepticism 20 years ago at a small science fiction convention called Icon 2, which was held in Victoria. I naturally gravitated to a panel discussion with a paranormal theme, which the program described this way. Telepathy, clairvoyance, telekinesis, they're great in fiction, but could they really work? Is there any scientific evidence to support the idea? Well, I thought I knew the answer to that. And I walked in expecting more of what I was used to. What I heard was life-altering, a road to Damascus moment, an experience that left me shaken and inspired.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, we'll learn about a few of the ways our brains are hardwired to fail at reality. Guest host Rochelle Saunders talks to Dr. Carol Tavris, co-author of Mistakes Were Made, But Not By Me, Why We Justify Foolish Beliefs, Bad Decisions, and Hurtful Acts. The best-selling book investigates cognitive dissonance and the fascinating ways that it affects our memories, as well as politics, business, and society. And we're joined by University of Toronto statistics professor Jeffrey S. Rosenthal to discuss why we're so bad at grasping probability. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking on your local radio station or online at skepticallyspeaking.com.
The difference was a sincere, kind-hearted speaker named Barry Beierstein, who was a psychopharmacologist at Simon Fraser University. He was the head of an organization I'd never heard of, the BC Skeptics, which he straightforwardly described as an educational organization that promotes scientific literacy. And promote some he did. A small crowd meant there was ample chance to pepper him with questions. "What about that spoonbender guy?" from the side of the room. "What's your take on UFOs?" from the other. We pitched them one after another, and he ever so gently knocked them right out of the park. Everyone. Now, that's not to say he had all the answers. He didn't. But it was clear that even his I don't knows were substantial in a way I wasn't used to hearing. Even the limits of his knowledge were defined by information I clearly didn't have. I remember his answer to one question in particular because it seemed so obvious once pointed out. What about firewalking? Well, Barry explained in his friendly, respectful way, it's all a matter of how materials store and conduct heat. Imagine a tray of muffins in an oven. Everything in the oven, the walls, the tray, the muffins, the air, they're all 350 degrees, whatever it is. But if you're careful and you move quickly, you can kind of jiggle the muffins out of the tray as long as you don't touch the sides or the racks. Light bulb. You mean these mysteries can actually be solved? You don't need new physics? You don't have to overturn the laws of the universe? And so I learned that I was missing key information. Information that popular culture sources steadfastly refused to provide. A minute ago, I called this realization a road to Damascus moment. This phrase usually refers to a dramatic conversion, a complete reversal, a sudden understanding that everything you used to believe is terribly, terribly wrong. What happened to me was actually a little bit different from that. I'm reminded of skeptic Isaac Asimov's comments about flat earth theory. Nowadays, of course, we are taught that the flat earth theory is wrong, that it is all wrong, terribly wrong, absolutely. But it isn't. The curvature of the earth is nearly zero per mile, so that although the flat earth theory is wrong, it happens to be nearly right. That's why the theory lasted so long. It's not that I suddenly felt I'd been wrong about everything, it's that I suddenly realized I was missing huge parts of the picture. Barry Byerstein handed out free copies of the BC Skeptics newsletter, which is just a thin little pamphlet thing. It was my first glimpse of something called the skeptical literature. I went away with a lot to think about. How could there be an entire parallel literature about my favorite topics, and I knew nothing about it? It was like I'd been walking past a treasure vault my entire life without ever noticing it, and suddenly I was handed a key. Some of you may recall a scene from the action movie Die Hard, in which the brilliant thieves succeed in opening the seventh lock of a vault containing hundreds of millions of dollars. As the door opens, light spills across their awestruck faces, and the soundtrack sweeps us forward into Ode to Joy. That's roughly how I felt the first time I stepped into my university library. I actually thought of things in cinematic terms like those in those days. I recall my astonishment when I realized there was an entire second story to the collection. I spent days there those first weeks. I found a lot of treasures, but the real jewel, the thing that helped set the course of my life, was hidden away in the periodical collection. A complete set of Skeptical Inquirer magazines, going back to its launch. I arrived on campus as a fledgling skeptic, now all too aware how little I knew. I had one small taste of the skeptical literature, my well-read, ragged copy of the thin BC Skeptics newsletter, and that kindled an intense interest, and I wanted more. And now, here were hundreds upon hundreds of pages of investigation and critique. I couldn't believe such a wealth of skeptical research existed. I returned every day, working my way through the stack hungrily, systematically. And that was it. I was head over heels. I had plenty of time to think about skepticism. A few of you may have heard that my first career was as a professional shepherd. It's true, I worked for about 10 years herding sheep, mostly along the BC side of the Alaska Panhandle. When I tell people that I was a shepherd, certain questions almost always come up. What, really, a shepherd? You mean with sheep? Did you have one of those sticks? You must have gotten a lot of riding done, huh? The answer to the first two questions is yes. I used to herd 1,500 or 2,000 sheep on tree plantations in northern BC. It is a lot of sheep. As a brush management tool. Most of the sheep were rented from Hutterite colonies right here in Alberta. It was a win-win-win-win-win situation. We made money from the brush removal service. The Hutterites got rent for the sheep. The sheep got fat. They had lots of lambs. The replanted baby trees got a little leg up over the weeds. And the timber companies got a cheap, effective brush management tool. And yes, we did have the sticks. They're called crooks. I advise shepherds never to leave home without one. They're like duct tape or a Leatherman. They're the perfect multi-tool for the job. But I had a hard time not rolling my eyes at that last question. We worked 16 hours a day, all of it on our feet, watching intensely and worrying. The work was like any farm or forestry job, hard, intense, occasionally dangerous. A lot of stuff can go wrong. I could tell you some stories, but they're bummers. I'll save that for another talk. So no, We couldn't read or write anything, but I did find it possible to read. Reading I could do on the fly, just a sentence or two at a time, like this, keeping an eye on the sheep. My brothers were also shepherds. All three of us got into the habit of carrying skeptical masterpieces in our backpack, battered copies of Skeptic magazine, Sagan's Demon Haunted World, Randy's Flim Flam, Martin Gardner's Facts and Fallacies in the Name of Science. I spent summers in the bush, winters at university. In the early 90s, I started discussing skepticism as part of my college radio shows. In the late 90s, my brother Jason and I co-hosted an off-campus skeptical speakers series and organized on-campus skeptics groups at UVic and Camosun College. We did some skeptical activism, Darwin Day events, newspaper columns, complaints about this and that. Eventually, I started contributing to the skeptical and humanist magazines I'd been reading all these years, first illustrations and eventually writing. I took over Junior Skeptic in 2002, and the rest is history. I'd like to finish today by asking you to imagine two people, Ada and B. Both are smart, reasonable, well-read. Both consider themselves critical thinkers. Both walk into a pharmacy looking for something to help with a headache. Ada buys a brand name headache medication because her loved ones swear by it, because she knows from experience that it works for her, and because her sources tell her that most of alternative medicine is hogwash. By contrast, B buys a homeopathic preparation because her loved ones swear by it, because she knows from experience that it works for her, and because her sources tell her that most of mainstream medicine is hogwash. Who's the villain in that story? There isn't one, or at least Ada and B aren't it. They're both just regular folks making regular decisions based on the best information they have available. Both are at the mercy of their sources, and as it happens, they're both partly right. But that does not mean that they're both equally right. Isaac Asimov put it like this: when people thought the earth was flat, they were wrong. When people thought the earth was spherical, they were wrong. But if you think thinking the earth is spherical is just as wrong as thinking the earth is flat, then your view is wronger than both of them put together. The difference between slightly true and mostly true does matter. I say that as a kid science writer and also as a parent. When we learn more about science, when we learn how to find and evaluate the best available information, we claim something beautiful for ourselves and for our children. Scientific literacy empowers us to better protect our children and provide them with opportunities. It helps us to make informed health decisions on their behalf. And most importantly, it allows us to take our kids by the hand and show them how big and wonderful the universe really is. Every child deserves to see from those great heights. It's a view that belongs to everyone, and yet it is concealed from so many. Because while every human deserves scientific literacy, it's not something we're born with. It's something we must be taught. Thank you.
Bring it on. The skeptics await your letter. You call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell. Break the spell of Pavlov's bells. Cause we're skeptically speaking online. Reading tarot cards and witches, psychics, and their spoon bending mind tricks. All the humbug, flim flam, frauds and shams, the charlatan who I don't think you understand. It's the hocus pocus, out of focus, locus, eroding the brain, making gains on the hopeless. Let the crystal ball fall, smash on the floor. Leave the pieces alone, we don't need them anymore. Just a microscope, telescope, magnifier, reading in between the lines of these lies. Bring it on. The skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, cause we're skeptically speaking.
Skeptically Speaking is produced with the support of CJSR 88.5 FM in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. Our studio assistants are Brent Kelly and Rochelle Saunders. Ryan Bromsgrove is our studio technician and research assistant. The show is produced and edited by K.O. Myers. Our theme song was written and recorded by A.O.K. And I'm your host, Desiree Shell.